A vertically conceived piece does not exhibit large-scale closure. It does not begin, but merely starts. It does not build to a climax, does not purposefully set up internal expectations, does not seek to fulfill any expectations that might arise accidentally, does not build or release tension, and does not end, but simply ceases.
And more. The aim of composition, of organization at any stage of the process, is not law and order, but particularity. The particularity of the event with respect to the structural values possible for it to assume, and the particularity of the work with respect to larger notions of what music might be.
Indeed, if one seeks evidence of Schoenberg's continuing and pervasive influence on musical culture in the 1990s, I suggest that one need look no further than the pages of the New York Times and reflect upon the remarkable frequency with which that newspaper has, periodically, felt compelled to reassure an evidently nervous readership that 12-tone music is dead.
In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna instructs Arjuna that the solution to the warrior's dilemma on the battlefield is in attaining spiritual illumination through increased self-awareness. Curving back on my own nature, I create again and again. It is difficult to imagine a more striking metaphor for the activity of the improviser.
In trying to decide how to analyze a passage, or in attempting to discover what a melody's true structural relations are, most theorists, for instance, have had the experience of watching their perceptions change as they sing a given phrase over and over.
So, the musical pun is pleasurable because it allows us, for a moment, to put aside some of our theoretical inhibitions. That pleasure is purchased at a price, however, for pleasure itself is often cause for other anxieties. To begin with, the mind feels guilt over having created a meaning that the theoretical language, the language enabling it to sustain music thought, abhors.
To approach 20th century works from the point of view of tonal music is to devalue their achievement. If we value these works, we will not want to view them as strange, deformed tonal compositions that employ traditional techniques grudgingly, incompletely, and unsuccessfully.
Music is an object for contemplation, not simply immediate experience. Such a synoptic understanding is manifestly not acquired in a single listening, but rather by the coordination of multiple hearings and mental rehearsals, in which the events of the piece, even temporally distant ones, are learned in detail and associated in various ways.
Tensions between analyses should not be regarded as merely byproducts of theoretical abstraction. Nor can one reading yield to the other a priori, because on one hand each corresponds in its own way to palpable effects in the music, and on the other hand they are insufficiently congruent with one another to permit a principled choice.
Impossible contours form a kind of negative space for contours in general. If multidimensional parameters are used, or a toric representation, it is easy to imagine how impossible contour illusions might be generated, like a morphological shepherd tone.
While not the cornerstone of the theory in the way that, say, diminution is, the interaction of the literal and the imagined is central to the Schenkerian way of hearing. By pointing to the implied tone, the presence and the absence, Schenker has brought us closer to the inner spirit of tonal music.
I am not proposing that women and men create music differently, or that they create different types of music. Rather, I suggest that women may expand our concepts of musical creativity.
One view is that objectivist knowledge is encoded and represented in the brain in some sort of schematic network or hierarchy. Alternatively, it might be viewed as an expert system with self-contained production rules, frames, and so on. The primary goal of instruction, therefore, becomes the development of this clear and well-organized schematic network in the minds of the learners.
I have chosen to define a good ear as one that perceives and retains musical structures and understands their role in a musical transformation or other compositional process. A good ear can be manifested in many ways: when a violinist plays in tune, when a pianist performs a complex piece accurately by memory, when a composer writes a piece that feels as if it has the right proportions.
To say that an acceptable theory must be approximately true, in addition to being empirically adequate, requires that the non-obvious entities, states, and processes referred to by the theory must actually exist. In other words, unlike the positivists, we cannot simply dismiss references to such things as theoretical fictions that help us predict sense experiences in given test situations.
Jackson's command of rhetoric was astounding. He discoursed flamboyantly, filling his speech with alliterations, puns, repetitions, and other figures. It struck me that the same process by which I was moved to applaud Jesse Jackson was at work in my appreciation of the B minor fugue, a process where doubt turns into belief, indifference into admiration.
I wanted to understand the extreme sense of intimacy one can feel for a musical work, an intimacy akin to that one feels for a lover, as well as some of the powers of music, powers of attraction, engagement, the power to care for the listener. A third way to respond to the willful detachment of theory from practice is to ask what exactly drives practice, if not some set of general principles which are capable of articulation in some form. To answer this question with some form of musical intuition guided by long experience is at best to claim an underlying competence, a dynamic, partially unconscious core of knowledge capable of producing an infinite number of, perhaps spontaneous, individual judgments in a principled, that is, non-arbitrary way.
Now, just how does one go about getting out from under? Once you become aware of the presence of unsought-after, incompatible, controlling forces, without behaving abusively.
In an arbitrary scale, we can define a generic interval in terms of scale step measure. If the scale possesses Myhill's property, that is, if seconds, thirds, and so forth come in exactly two sizes, it can be shown that the scale is a non-degenerate, well-formed scale.
So what have we, as performers, learned from our analysis and from our experience of performing these songs? How has analysis helped our singer in the very daunting task of just learning the notes? And what strategies can she adopt to make the most effective use of her rehearsal time?
Music theory is about communicating about music using some kind of language. But music itself is not about communication. The whole category of being about does not apply within it, except in ancillary ways, such as music composed partly out of ready-made signifiers.
Are the same pathways that we use to hum a tune the ones we use to recognize a hat? The jury's out. The verdict's yet to come on that. Can synapses that the brain and eyes require to grasp a shape also construe what brain and ears have heard?
If some of the elements of set A invert with respect to index X, while the other elements of A invert with respect to index Y, the resulting set B may be neither a simple transposition nor a simple inversion of A, but both sets may nonetheless share the same interval class vector. That is, A and B may be Z-related.
The natural state of music is dissolving episodes. Only by a bizarre act of arbitrarily hypostatization is it reified as monumental artifacts with persistent and verifiable entityhood. The musical work is an essential fiction of materialist culture, which requires object permanence and measurable quantitative substance for the assignment of value, since the paradigm of all value is material value.
The inner-outer formal dichotomy exemplifies the Western predilection for binary oppositions, such as reality, appearance, presence, representation, mind, body, subject, object, and so forth. The problem with such oppositions, to cite Derrida again, is that they are, quote, never the face-to-face of two terms, but a hierarchy and an order of subordination, end quote. In any polarity of this type, one term dominates the other and does so all the more effectively when the hierarchy of values is concealed.
While early 20th century composers constructed their PC relations, jazz musicians heard them in their improvisations, which suggests that pitch class and non-tonal relations can develop naturally out of musical practice, in the same way that tonal music grew out of modal music, and 19th century tonality grew out of that of the 18th century.
The analyst can proceed to a preliminary interpretation by looking for the metaphorical equivalence of purely musical devices. How, for example, does a modulation mean? How do voice exchanges signify? What image of process is communicated by middle ground arpeggiations?
We can conclude that under certain conditions at least, perception of music can be strongly influenced by the language spoken by the listener.
Diatonicism is a fact that there are different, exquisitely different versions of and approaches to diatonicism is also a fact. Do our findings tell us what were the most flavorful, meaningful, or powerful features of early Indian musical practice and the mental processes of its performers and theorists? Surely not.
Neither foot nor hand can rest long enough to balance the body. For these few terrifying measures, terrifying in the organist's experience, one might as well be floating in midair, so confused and constantly shifting is the body's center of gravity. None of this is audible, except possibly as wrong notes, muddled articulations, or some subtle way the organist's return to bodily ease will result in more confident playing.
What then is to be done? Will we end up confronted with Hobson's choice? Forced either to declare minimal music beyond analysis owing to the inadequacies of theory, or to dismiss the music as unworthy owing to its inability to stand up to analysis.
By understanding the principles guiding the growth of trees or the interactions of the wind and water, we can better appreciate the dialectic of the singular within the totality, the moment within the flow of time. So too it is with Babbitt's music.
We see to what extent music everywhere is steeped in time, time in the form of impalpable flux, or time in its frozen form, outside time, made possible by memory. Time is the blackboard on which are inscribed phenomena and their relationships outside the time of the universe where we live.
Moreover, where they appear to offer choice between X or Y, I offer instead X and Y.